You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Well, 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 we're back on Radical Australia and Daryl has come back for another round.
Yep, yep, can't get rid of me.
Well, I couldn't find
my way out. That's the only reason.
Well, that's why we locked you in the room last Wednesday, Dan. We did feed you under the door. We put some matzah bread under the door, you know, flat bread for you.
Oh,
and you wonder where that came from, didn't you? How are the podcasts going?
Yeah, good. Progressing well. I've managed to put another three up this week. Bang, bang, bang. It's just catching up, though.
Catching up?
Yeah, I'm only up to June.
Yeah, can you tell us what little program you're talking about? Hopefully it's not Radical Australia. They should be up every week.
No.
Good.
Better than that.
This is your little program, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, yeah. This is our breadline.
Oh, God.
Yep.
Well, yeah. I got some good news for you.
Yeah?
Look, I drive a lot and I've seen a lot of empty shops lately for lease signs. So unemployment should be going up. So you should get more members for your organisation.
Mm, yeah. Right.
So there's always a silver line to every cloud, isn't there?
Yeah. Well, so I was thinking that with Car House too, like 70 people. When that closes down, 70 staff members are going to lose their job.
Yeah.
And so I'm thinking, well, maybe I can go around to, you know, spruik our union with them too, because they'll probably need us, you know.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you, Daryl, for stepping into the void, and we'll let you out this week.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Now, we have Sally Gibson with us, a recidivist. Hello.
Hello.
Didn't I have you here a few years ago?
You did.
What were you doing then? You were kind of trying to become a politician or something like me, a failed politician?
Yeah, I was standing as an independent in state government in the seat of Brighton.
Brighton, yes.
And I also spoke to you about my trip to Antarctica last year.
That's right, yeah. You still, have you got over that?
No. Can I ever get over that? How do you get over that?
Well, I don't know. Maybe you die and then you forget about it.
Well, I went to India recently and that was pretty interesting.
It's which parts of India?
All around southern India.
Southern India, right.
I've got Anglo-Indian history, family history.
What do you mean?
Well, my grandmother used to say we had Indian blood and my father used to poo-poo it. Mm-hmm. But when he passed away, I decided to look into it and I found that it was in fact true.
What?
Yes, I know.
How horrendous.
I've changed my whole identity. I've changed my name and everything. I wear Indian bracelets.
Yeah, I noticed that. You got so many bracelets, I thought you'd break your wrist. So what do you mean you change your name to what?
No. Well, Kalavati. I'm adopting an Indian name from my Indian ancestors' village.
Have you actually been able to actually trace them?
Yeah.
And did they tell you to go away?
Well, I haven't found my Indian relatives as such because the marriage certificate or the certificate where her name should be when she gave birth to her Anglo-Indian daughter doesn't include her name. It's only the name of her corporal British Army husband.
Right. Yes, as it should be. As it was.
So I've recently found that you can actually there's a DNA site related to people in India.
Yes.
So you can join that, put your DNA up and see if you've got any matches.
All right.
So I'll go that route.
Sounds good.
But there are other members of the latest generation are getting high scores for India on their DNA. Right.
So this corporal, is he a great something?
Great.
Right. You know what they used to say about these people? They've gone native.
Yes.
When you go down having your gin and tonic, they talk about somebody going native, you
know. That's right. Yeah. Well, there were a lot of marriages because there weren't any white women to marry when in the early sort of 1800s, late 1700s.
Yep.
And the officers were encouraged to marry Indian women.
That's right.
And sometimes they actually formally married them, or if there wasn't a church, they just cohabitated and procreated. And I wouldn't be here if that hadn't happened.
Well, that's right. Who knows what our backgrounds are. Now, yesterday was an important day for you.
It was. It was a really, really big day for me. Yeah, it
Why?
Was. Well, it was the 50th anniversary of the what's called the sacking of the Whitlam Labor government in 1975. And I...
Mum, you use another word, don't you? You don't use sacking, don't you? You use the C word.
I do use the C word.
Could you tell us what the C word is and why?
Well, the C word is there was a staging of a coup against a Labor government, legitimately elected Labor government in 1975 by a representative of Queen Elizabeth.
And what's your definition of a coup?
My definition of a coup is something, well, it's not my definition. I think if you look it up on Merriam-Webster,
whatever.
Is that it's a sudden, illegal, and sometimes violent seizure of power.
So it doesn't necessarily have to be violent. It doesn't have to be blood in the streets.
It does not have to be blood. It was a bloodless coup, although many tears were shed. Right. But it was a bloodless coup. But it was, in fact, in my view, most definitely a coup.
So where were you when it had happened?
Oh, well, I was a student at Melbourne University when it happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I was studying political science. I was a political science nut. And I think I was due to attend an exam on the day it happened because it was the end of the year. And when I heard the news, I thought, oh, forget the exam. I'll just go down to the city in the hope that people were gathering. And I remembered that they weren't gathering, so they thought, oh, God, I've missed my exam. But the next opportunity to protest was when Kerr came to Melbourne within that week, within the next week or so, and went to the American embassy, and interestingly, and I was part of a protest at that embassy, which did include mounted police. So I don't think we were throwing marbles under the police's feet or anything. But I do remember it being tumultuous.
Right. And so when was your next association with the dismissal?
Well, of course, we were required to maintain our rage. The former Prime Minister, Gough Whitlam, had asked us to maintain our rage. So we did our very best to maintain our rage. And I certainly did maintain my rage, and as did most of my family, well, all my family. And
So why would your family maintain their rage?
Well, my father was a very big fan of Gough.
Mm-hmm.
He'd taken me when I was in Form 5 to a campaign launch for the 72 election. That was pretty exhilarating and interesting. He loved Gough. He thought Gough was fantastic. And my mother was always a Labor voter, so she was very pro-Gough as well. All my brothers and sisters, we were raised in a sort of Irish Catholic political milieu, and we were Labor people. But my next encounter with the dismissal was later on when I was working at the Age newspaper as a young journalist.
Did you get your degree from Melbourne University?
I did.
And what was the degree?
It was pure politics honours at Melbourne Uni.
Politics honours.
Yeah, and pure. So it was
pure.
Yeah. Minor and a major in politics.
You wouldn't get that these days, would you?
Why is that?
I don't know. I mean, aren't they getting rid of all the arts courses, increasing the fees?
That's right.
Because obviously you people have got nothing to contribute to the world, have you?
Well, it was a... No, that's right. But
That's
what they say. But it was free education, thanks to Gough. We got to go to uni for free. That.
Well, no, not exactly. I started university in 1970. I had a Commonwealth scholarship. That's what they used to give us. And then it became free.
Yes, yes.
Extraordinary.
Extraordinary. So my mother went to school and then went on to uni. She did politics as well. Wow. So she was a beneficiary of Gough's decision to free up the cost of...
So you're in the Age. So what's going on?
So I was at the Age. I was... because I'd done this politics degree, I was keen to go up to Parliament in Canberra. But I'd been engaged as what was called a special writer on the Age, so to write features and colour stories across the paper. Peter Smark, who was a well-known journalist and associate editor at the time, and was a little bit frustrated that I wasn't able to follow my passion in terms of my political interests. Anyway, I was asked to do a feature spending a week in a massage parlour in East St Kilda following one of the sex workers.
Mm-hmm.
And my role in the actual massage parlour was to be the receptionist because I was incognito.
Right.
So I had a very interesting week, learnt a lot about prostitution. came to some conclusions about that and wrote the article as well, the feature as like a three-act play.
Right.
So it was with dialogue and so on.
What year was this?
This is 1981.
Right.
Then soon after that, within a couple of weeks, the phone rang and it was a movie producer called Byron Kennedy who produced the Mad Max movie, Mad Max 1 mm-hmm. and Mad Max 2.
Just in case people don't understand, what is a producer?
A producer is someone who... There's two different types of producers in a TV show or a movie. One is an executive producer who makes all the big decisions and manages all the legal side of the contracts and all that sort of thing and helps raise the funds critically. Mm. There's another type of producer called a line producer, and that producer's job is to actually, you know, it's like a project manager to bring the product to air. Mm. So Byron was the producer of an executive producer of the Mad Max movies.
Why would this successful person bother to call this young reporter on The Age?
Well, I knew them as acquaintances.
Right.
Byron and George Miller, Dr. George Miller, his mm-hmm. partner.
Yep.
I knew them through Terry Hayes, who'd been the producer of the Darren Hinch show in right. Melbourne mm-hmm. at the time on 3AW. So I knew Terry. The three of them had come to a couple of cup parties that I'd had with my then husband. We knew them as acquaintances. So he knew that I had studied politics because I was studying politics at the time. I think I probably met him. Mm-hmm. So he knew that and he called and he said, we're thinking of doing a mini-series on the sacking of the Whitlam government. I know that you've done politics and that we saw you wrote this article like a screenplay. He said, would you like to write us a three-page summary, an outline of the sacking of the Whitlam government that we could use to pitch a TV miniseries? Mm. And, of course, I was rapt to be able to do that. And
well, you would have been in your mid-20s, weren't you?
I was about 23, 24.
23, yeah. Very young for yeah. such big... They must have actually had high hopes for you.
They?
Yes, the people who rang you, the producers.
They were only 29.
Oh, right.
We're all young, yeah.
29-year-olds are still living at home these days because of,
exactly.
of the economic situation.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But they'd made a mozza out of Mad Max 2
right.
and had a lot of money and to invest in making productions to, in some ways, sort of research the breadth of talent in Australia for projects going forward. So they had this idea of doing the sacking of the Whitlam government. So I did my outline. It was put to Channel 10, and apparently they did prevaricate at the time about whether or not Australians would be interested in politics. But in the end...
Excuse me. Australians had just, 6 years previously seen the dismissal of a government which was interested in redistributing wealth, and people had had so many positives come out of it individually, and they were concerned, the board was concerned that Australians were not interested in politics.
Yes.
Oh, I like that. It sounds like today, doesn't it?
But decided perhaps they might be.
They might be right.
And they might have been, you know, I don't know the machinations of the Channel 10 board at the time. And then I was asked to come to Sydney and write spend 5 weeks researching the series. And of course.
Hang on. Series.
Miniseries.
Yeah, how many?
6 hours.
6 hours?
Yes.
That's a lot of work.
It was a lot. It was a hell of a lot.
A lot of work.
It was, yes.
What was that first 5 weeks like?
Well, I knew, of course, it would take a lot longer than that. It was such a massive story and it really required tense, meticulous research. And I'd just finished a major thesis, as you know, on 3CR.
Yeah.
And so I was in the zone of, you know, I loved research and the cut and thrust of finding out gems and all that sort of stuff. So I knew it would take a lot longer than the 5 weeks. So I moved up to Sydney for the 5 weeks, but in the expectation it would take a lot longer than that. So, by 5 weeks, I guess it became clear to them as well that, you know, it was going to need, you know, to be factual. There had been a theatrical writer brought in initially who was starting to write the story as if, use his imagination, and it just be difficult for me to stay on the project if it was going to be like that. So in the end, Terry Hayes took over the writing and I was involved. I wrote all the, did all the research and did all the, what's called...
So This is pre Lynette. What did research entail?
Okay, so good question. So I amassed all the books that had been written on it. Gough had written a book called The Truth of the Matter. So John Kerr had published a book called Matters for Judgment. They're both quite thick tomes. That several journalists had written books as well. And also there was TV coverage and there were the news clippings. So I amassed all that material. And then I carefully cross-referenced every scene, every possible sort of step in the story against all these sources and weighed up the evidence for every scene and just to make sure that they were as accurate as possible. And in the end, it was something like 300 scenes that I described. And then Terry wrote out and I participated in the parliamentary scenes in relation to that series.
Let's get back to it. So you did all the background research?
Yes.
And you had to go to, well, original sources, basically.
Correct.
Were you able to talk to any of the major people involved, like Fraser or Whitlam or Kerr?
I was asked to try, of course. Mm-hmm. So someone, I think, from Fairfax newspapers up in Sydney slung me Whitlam's phone number.
Right.
And I wasn't entirely sure where I was ringing, but I knew it was Whitlam, you know. So Whitlam was my first cab off the rank.
What, you got onto him directly? Or?
I got onto him directly from I was living in a terraced house in Glebe in Sydney with five other people, you know, hippie-style house. And there we had a telephone, a landline under the stairs. And I remember bracing myself to go and choose a time when no one else was home at 10 a.m. in the morning and make this phone call. So there I was, you know, all of 24 or whatever I was, and dialing Gough Whitlam, my hero,
right.
My absolute hero, right? He answered the phone. I said, oh, hello, Mr. Whitlam, Sally Gibson, I'm blah, 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 blah. He said, how dare you call me on my private number? Oh, my God. but as my dad could be a bit gruff too, I thought, I'm not putting up with this, And I recovered myself and I said, well, I'm very sorry, Mr. Whitlam, but where may I contact you? And he sort of piped down again. He said, well, you may call me tomorrow at my office, which I did. And I said, thank you very much, Mr. Whitlam. Goodbye. And then I actually never recovered from that abuse. I still have the feeling of my hero abusing me in my body.
It's the old story, isn't it? You've got somebody you've idolised from afar and then you meet the real thing and you think, what's that all about? Did you ring him the next day at his office?
Yes, right. I did. And he politely declined the interview on the basis that he wanted to reserve his right to sue for libel,
right,
and didn't want to be seen to be collaborating with us.
Right, okay. Well, obviously when he heard Channel 10, he was a bit concerned.
So the next person was Mr. Fraser, who was, of course, the Prime Minister at the time.
Mm. And did you get his private number?
No, I did not.
No, right.
I knew where to find him.
Right.
And
Hang on. You knew how to find him?
Well, where's he going? He was in the Prime Minister's office.
Oh, right.
So,
what, you just wandered down, no invitation?
No, I rang the Prime Minister's office.
Right.
And I think, you know, as I recall, I think it was a lackey who said, no, he wouldn't be involved. But as a consequence of that, they knew what we were up to.
Mm-hmm.
He was still in office. And soon after that, I had a phone call to the studios of where we were shooting The Dismissal, saying, oh, hello, I'm from the Prime Minister's office. Would you meet me? Tell me what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I told the production and my producers, and they were aware that was happening. So I went down to this cafe in King's Cross. I think it was the Fishbowl.
Right.
And this very large, kind of intimidating gentleman who, you know, by that stage I was thinking he was with ASIS or something.
Right.
And
did he have the pugilistic nose and the large hands?
He did.
Yeah, that's the type they used to send round. That's right. Not unusual.
He was twice as big as me in both directions.
Yeah, right.
anyway, he proceeded to grill me about, you know, what this series would be like. Would it be balanced and so forth? And I reassured him.
Yes.
Oh, this was absolutely very balanced. Mm. And
it is Channel 10, not the ABC. I hope you're reinforced.
That's right, that's right. So, so he seemed to be quite satisfied after about an hour and a half.
Did he actually pay for the coffee or did you have to pay for his coffee?
No, he did pay for the coffee. But in those days it was just, you know, sort of water, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But he did make another appointment with me. He said, I'll come and see you at the end of your work and just see how it all went. Which he did. So,
And how about Mr. Kerr?
Well, Mr. Kerr, now he was long gone by that stage.
Long gone.
Yeah, he was long gone.
He was tired and emotional a lot of times, I understand.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And after the dismissal, he'd really never regained his composure.
He did not. He may have already been in Paris by that stage. Remember, he went and lived in Paris.
Yes, yes.
But look, I never got to speak to Kerr at all, mm-hmm. and I tried to get a message through to him, but you know nothing came back, as I recall, and so I couldn't.
So the production is now every scene after scene has been recorded. Is it? Has the recording started?
No. This is all the
preparation. Right.
Yeah. It was went on and on, but the actors were being hired. But really, the interesting thing is that I'd also been abused by Fraser.
Abused
when I was a journalist at The Age.
Right. What, he personally?
Well, dressed down.
Picked up the phone.
Dressed down.
Why? What did you do?
Well, because of I was maintaining my rage.
All right.
I was sent along to a story to do with Fraser, where Fraser, as Prime Minister, was opening a book fair of some nature at the Royal Exhibition Buildings.
Mm-hmm.
And I was told to go and ask him, or I'd said I would go and ask him, what was the last book he read? Which back in the day was sort of an insult,
an insulting
question. So
yeah, it's like, what's the cost of a pint of milk?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I asked Fraser this question. Of course, he was, you know, twice my height as well. And he turned around and he just dressed me down for having the gall to ask such a question.
Mm.
And so I've got a photo of that.
All right.
So I'd had these two experiences with the chief gladiators of the dismissal event.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
So it gave me all I really needed to know about the key characters and the personalities that were involved and in the matters.
So I just want to clarify this in my mind. You're doing this research. You're passing this on to Terry Hodges, who's writing
Hayes, who's
writing the script. Now, what are you giving him?
I'm giving him scene breakdowns. So a scene breakdown is a full description of how each scene should be written.
Mm-hmm.
So it's called a scene breakdown, summary of each scene. So it was the dialogue. So once I'd come to a conclusion as to what was actually said in a scene, who was there in the scene, where the scene was held, etc., I would write this in what's called a scene breakdown of the scene, and then Terry would put it into the format of the scene, format. So, there were many, you know, there were hundreds of these scenes. And then the script was starting to come together, and then we were hiring actors. The actors were being brought on board. And that was a big process to choose people who could accurately depict, and not just by looks, but also by bring together the feel of these very well-known public figures.
So who are the three main actors for the three characters?
Well, Max Phipps played Gough Whitlam.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't so well-known in Melbourne, very well-known actor in Sydney. John Stanton played Malcolm Fraser. John, I believe, now lives in Central Victoria,
mm-hmm.
and also John Mellion played John Kerr.
Mm.
So they were the three key actors.
Did this do anything for any of their careers, participation?
Well, very interestingly, at the end of the show, when we were in post-production, I interviewed every single actor on the show to find out just all about how they felt about the show, what they did, what the research they did to try and bring the characters to life and their background, and also what they thought they might do afterwards. And to a man, they all said, well, probably like Bill Hunter, who played Rex Connor.
Mm-hmm.
Bill said, oh, I'll probably just go back to the taxi, driving taxis.
Right.
And or, you know, someone else went, so I'll just go and start pulling beers again at the bar.
Right.
You know, you would think that having played such prominent roles that the TV industry would be their oyster, but it's the industry is so small in Australia that it never really happened like that.
Right. Look, it's 4:30. This is Radical Australian Community Radio 3CR, streaming live on 3cr.org.au. We're having a chat, as yesterday was the 50th anniversary of the coup, or the dismissal, whatever you like to call it, of the Gough Whitlam-led Labor government, with Sally Gibson, who was instrumental, not the only one, but instrumental in creating the series The Dismissal.
You're listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned to hear the rest of your 3CR podcast.
Now, I am exceptionally interested in how long it took to make the series.
Okay. So the series, at that stage, recently there'd been a tax break brought in, I think by Fraser, for TV producers. And it meant that if they had the show in the can by the end of the financial year, they'd be able to claim a tax benefit
for their investment. So there's a rush.
There was a rush. So I started work in November and we had to have it in the can 8 months later.
Right.
So it was a real rush. And as a consequence, I worked every single day and night, including weekends, for 8 months. Because I was very concerned that be accurate, you know, because it was such an important thing. And then from the production side of things, it was massive. It was a massive production because the actors had to get in character. We had a three-week actor workshop before shooting began so that they could meet some of the people they were trying to portray. So people like Jim Cairns and Gina Morosi, Bill Hayden came along to the actors' workshop.
Do you remember who portrayed Gina Morosi?
Well, I do. I can't bring a name to mind.
But
right
when it comes, no rush,
yeah,
no rush.
Yeah,
yeah. No rush.
Yeah, she was a lovely girl and she did a terrific job.
Mm-hmm.
John Hargraves played Jim Cairns and he met him on set and got to know him.
Oh. So Jim Cairns was happy to be involved.
Yeah. Mm. And Junie came along with her husband.
Right.
To the actor's workshop, which we held at a magnificent estate in Sydney called the Rose Bay Estate.
Right.
And where we shot the Yarralumla scenes.
So how many people are involved in this? Not just the cast, but all the extra people.
Yeah, look,
This sounds very expensive.
It was expensive. I think it was $250,000 per episode.
Per episode?
Yeah.
And there were
6 hours.
So in those days, that's real money.
Yeah, it was real money. These days, that's nothing.
No, it's nothing.
It's a week's weeks worth of stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was I was looking actually at the credits the other night because I've only just seen the whole thing all the way through.
Mm-hmm.
And
why is that?
Well, because I was so bound up in the nuance and every word and every gesture and every, you know, element of every single scene, I couldn't bear to watch it. You know, it was sort of excruciating.
Mm-hmm.
So it really, I mean, I saw some of it shot, I saw some of the rushes, I saw some of the bits and pieces of it when people would ask to watch it with me over the years, but I'd never seen it all the way through.
True. And what did you think seeing
it
all the
way? I was really impressed.
You're impressed. Wow.
I know.
So when did the shooting finish?
But I was impressed by the work of my colleagues, you know.
The
sets were fantastic. Yeah. The costuming was brilliant.
Yeah, yeah.
The camera work was magnificent.
Yeah.
It was all that other
well,
stuff.
Well, I'm pleased you've rectified that statement. You said you were impressed.
By
everything, the way it all came together.
The way it all came together, because people would say to me, oh, the dismissal, you know, and I sort of really didn't know what they meant.
Now, I'm a bit confused here. When did you finish shooting? What year?
We finished shooting 1982.
And I assumed it was put to air the next year?
Well, you would think it might be put to air immediately, but Fraser was in power. He was Prime Minister.
Right.
And Channel 10 held it over a couple of times because they did not wish to be seen to be party to the result of the election by showing this, you know, educating the Australian public
right.
about these events.
About Fraser's role in these events.
Yeah.
Which were quite mercenary, really.
Very, very mercenary.
Yeah.
So,
could you explain his role?
Okay. So Fraser, I guess, it's quite a long story and quite involved, but he took the... He was representing... We called him Fraser the Grazier.
Yeah.
He was a Western District Grazier from, you know, our Australian aristocracy.
Yep.
His grandfather had actually helped draft the Australian Constitution. And Fraser was representing
the coalition. Well, what we call the Born to Rule Brigade, who were shocked with the election of the Whitlam-led Labor government.
Horrified.
And with the redistribution of wealth agenda they carried out. He was shocked. Couldn't believe it.
Well, horrified. Now, he was representing big corporate Australia, big agribusiness, the miners, mining companies, big corporate. And so he did what they wanted, basically, which was to resist as much as possible this government continuing on its reformist path, because it had done some very radical reforms. It had recognised China, the first Western country to recognise China before the US did. It had made education free, so, you know, all the plebs were able to go to Melbourne Uni and so on, bringing the tone down somewhat, introduced Medicare, pulled us out of the Vietnam War. It just went on and on.
There were 250 reforms which were passed in less time than the Albanese-led Labor Party has been in power. And if you think, you try to scratch your head about the reforms that they've passed during the same period, it's just unbelievable.
They can't do it anymore.
Especially when you've got a Prime Minister who was raised in public housing by a single parent who enjoyed the benefits of the Whitlam Labor government reform to give single women, single mothers, the pension, and before they had to adopt their kids out because there was no support.
Yep. Exactly.
You think he'd remember where he came from.
You would. Yeah.
So it finished. So when was it aired?
So it was aired. The election in 1983, the federal election, went forward on the 5th of March 1983, and Fraser lost to Bob Hawke, who by then was the leader of the Labor Party, and the show went to air the very next night for three nights in a row, 2 hours each night. I do remember that very well. It was very heady times.
Mm. And this is a commercial network.
They wouldn't
do that today.
No.
They wouldn't have the resources.
No. But that my hope had always been that it would be able to be aired before the election, and therefore help, change
the government.
But government got changed in any event.
So how was it received by the Australian public?
Well, extremely well. I think at the time the ratings figure that I heard at the time was 81, and I'm not sure what that meant at the time, but I've looked it up recently, and it said that 42% of people watching TV over that period watched the show.
Right.
So it was the biggest rating show of all time.
Mm-hmm.
So there was most definitely an appetite for politics, but it wasn't politics, it was a drama. We wrote it as a drama. So it was very involving. People knew the characters. It was a true story. It's nothing like a true story. And we wrote it very factually. There wasn't anything made up about it.
Right.
So it was, and people were very familiar with the events and some of the stories. They didn't really understand the whole story, which is why I was keen to be involved.
Mm-hmm.
They knew bits of it. They knew about this scandal and that scandal.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't actually understand the political manoeuvrings, the subterfuge, the really illegality of what Kerr did. It hadn't come through them. Commercial media.
Right.
And so, you know, my interest in being involved in the project was to try and educate Australians about the actual flow of events.
Mm-hmm. You would think that maybe they would have resurrected it for the 50th anniversary.
You would think, but interestingly, they did not. But when I watched it last weekend, I thought, God, this has really held up really well.
Yeah.
You know, it could easily be reshown. Mm. But no, it hasn't happened.
Now, I just got a question about the son of the working classes, Mr. Bob Hawke. Now, you talk about maintaining the rage. Could you explain Bob Hawke's role as president of the ALP and the ACTU in the events after the dismissal or the coup?
Yes. Well, prior to the dismissal, there had been a forced double dissolution, which means the opposition forced the hand of the government, forcing it to go to election for both the Senate and the House of Representatives, only within 18 months of the government being in power. It might have been a year.
Well, that's right. Without the double dissolution, there'd be no Medicare, and many other reforms that needed parliamentary approval were only passed after the result of the double dissolution
election. Yeah, because the Senate kept refusing.
That's right. Because the Whitlam-led Labor government never had a Senate majority.
That's right.
Unlike the Albanese Labor government, which has got a record Labor majority, not a record majority, but a record Labor majority, and a sympathetic radical reformist Senate, and they refused to use it. Sad. Very sad. But let's get him back to the son of the working classes.
So just a comment on what you've just said was that the Senate knocked back more bills in those 3 years of the Labor government than it had ever knocked back in the 72 prior years of federal government.
Mm-hmm.
It's shocking. Anyway, so Bob Hawke at that stage, 1974, when they'd been forced to the first election, Bob Hawke had threatened a general strike. But when it came to the actual coup in 1975, he refrained from that. And because he then became the leader after Whitlam, my feeling is that he probably hoped that that would happen, that he would become the leader, and therefore wanted to keep sweet with the powers that be.
Well, he set off the neoliberal revolution, him and Keating, in Australia. Now, so has the dismissal ever been aired again anywhere?
No.
So who owns the rights?
Oh, well, I suppose Channel 10 would.
Not the producers. They put the money in, or?
No, I think, you'd sell it. I don't know if they sold the license for them to show it or if they sold it to them. I don't know. But you can see it if you look up YouTube. It's available in parts 1, 2, and 3. So if you just look up the dismissal part 1, dismissal part 2, dismissal part 3, you can watch the whole thing.
You can watch that.
Without ads.
Without ads. That's even better.
Without ads.
Right. So were you involved in any more major productions after that, or did you find yourself hiding in a corner?
Well, after that, I did go back to journalism. I worked on the National Times as their arts editor for a year. But then Kennedy Miller had another couple of projects they were looking to make, and one was called Bodyline, which is about the cricketing.
That's right, yep.
Don't ask me all the details about
it. Well, yeah, when the Poms came here and they thought we're going to bowl at the batsman, we're not going to bowl at the bat.
Yep. Correct.
And they actually won.
Yes. So there was that idea, and the other idea was a show called The Cowra Breakout.
Oh, yes.
Which was about, during World War II, Japanese POWs who were collected in basically Papua New Guinea were brought to Australia and interned for the remainder of the war.
At Cowra,
and they
right.
were interned in a small country town in New South Wales called Cowra. Now, because of the incredible indignity for Japanese to be taken prisoner, the leaders of that 1,000 Japanese in that camp planned a breakout from the prison. And this is country
That's
New
right.
South Wales.
Yep.
And when they broke out, there were machine guns
That's
all
right.
around.
Well, I think there were 4 machine gun emplacements.
Correct.
And they were told to go out and die like the carp.
They were.
Die they like were. The carp. That's what their officers said. And I think about 334 were killed on the
yeah.
day. Many others were recaptured.
Yeah, we should have a talk about this one because this is a big story too.
Yeah, because if you go to Cowra these days, it's their major tourist attraction, believe it or not.
Oh, it is.
The park and the story, because it's an extraordinary story.
Extraordinary, because 281, Japanese were killed.
Mm.
And many escaped into the countryside and tried to live off the sheep so on.
Yeah, and they were brought back.
And I spent a lot of time in Cowra researching that story and also went to Japan.
Mm-hmm. What was that like, interviewing the survivors?
POWs was incredible because almost to a person, we interviewed 25 POWs, former POWs. They have an association from that Cowra breakout, and they... almost to a person, their initial response was to apologise for causing such consternation to Australians, who they've since become very friendly with. They visit Cowra, and there's a lot of interrelationships between people in Cowra and these Japanese POWs and their families.
Yeah.
So, interestingly, many of them had never told their family, their wife, what had happened because of the continuing shame. And in many cases, we were sitting there while the wives heard for the first time, or the wives were asked to leave the room while they told us the story in private.
Mm.
But one of the most interesting things that I recall from that research project was one POW who brought out a little collection of things from his, you know, treasures. And there was among it a little tin, and he opened the tin and showed us that when they were fighting in Papua New Guinea, they had been given a box of notes, currency, in yen, Japanese yen, but with the Sydney Harbour Bridge.
Shown it, yeah.
And I actually cited that, so I know that that's true, that they were given that.
Right.
And, that was like a bit of a cognitive dissonance moment.
Mm.
Yeah, so look, that was a terrific trip. There were five of us on board, two directors and an interpreter and so on. And we travelled the length and breadth of Japan.
Mm. Look, I'm interested in coming back to 2025 because you're talking about series which were done by commercial stations for commercial reasons, and there's nothing wrong with that. But I'm interested in 2025 with the advent of the internet, the advent of so-called reality TV, which is, you know, peppercorn payment TV. Do you think such series could ever again? You just shook your head.
Well, not on free-to-air television, but, you know, Netflix and Dan and all those sort of services have taken over, haven't they?
Yes, yes.
And they sometimes invest a lot in series.
Because we've got some great stories in this country which haven't been told. Oh, they're Australia. Everywhere. Everywhere. Everywhere.
Everywhere.
Yeah.
But we just hear, you know, I'm watching a series of stuff on Netflix at the moment. It's all about American crimes.
But,
you know, I think, well, where's, you know, our stories are just incredible.
Mm.
You know, the Cameliers, the, you know, it just goes on and on way back. And I did go on to research a series on the making of, on Federation, how our Federation came about further later years. And, you know, that's a great story as well.
Well, it is. I've actually just done a presentation on that. A great
story. Really?
I still don't forget the people of New South Wales.
No, of course not.
I'll never forget them. They didn't want to look after us, the rest of us bludgers.
And to make the capital, so close to Sydney.
That's right.
Come on.
Come on, yeah. And the first referendum they had, they actually said they didn't want to be part of a federation.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, because they said everybody would bludge on them.
Yeah, and WA was going to secede, and
That was it was after. And then that was It's an interesting story that because WA, if you look at the preamble, WA is not mentioned in the Australian constitutional preamble because they only joined 3 days after the British Parliament had approved the Australian Constitution. So they're not. It's not just Indigenous people are not in the preamble. No, it's West Australians.
That's true. That's a really good story.
That's a great story.
Yeah, that is another really great story.
And then the funny part was that in 1936, when they voted to secede, the Federation said, "Oh, piss off! You can't secede." So they went to the High Court. What do you call it? The Privy Council. to appeal, because you could appeal to the Privy Council in those days before the Hawke-Keating government abolished that in 86.
Exactly.
So they appealed to the Privy Council, and this is what big losers they were. The Privy Council said that, I think 2 years previously, the British Parliament had passed legislation they could not interfere in the affairs of their colonies that had achieved independence. So they couldn't actually hear the case. That's a story in itself.
Yeah, I know. I mean, they go on and on and on. Yeah. And, I mean, even just the dramatisation of all those, you know, Henry Lawson stories. And,
yeah, Blood on the Wattle.
Yeah.
Or the, look, something I've been involved in for almost 20 years is the Tunaminui Mulbohina story.
Oh, yes.
Now, that's, you need about 20 million to make that story.
Oh,
that is just an extraordinary local story.
Yes.
You got love.
Yes.
You got compassion.
Oh,
you got tyranny.
Yes.
It's everything. Human relationships you could.
It's almost unbelievable it hasn't been made into something.
Exactly. It's just extraordinary. All those stories we have. What have you been doing lately since we last spoke to you? I remember, is your political ambitions as fraught as mine, or have you?
As fraught, is that?
Yeah.
Well, you know, there's work to be done.
I like that. You've got positivity.
Yeah,
okay.
Yes, it's definitely still work to be done. My independent position has definitely not changed. I mean, it's probably hardened up because of what I'm seeing in terms of Labor and Labor's failure to really look after the people, instead looking after its big donors and you know, the construction industry through that. I mean, it just goes on and on. And, of course, the coalition now with their refusal to accept net zero, I mean, that's just horrendous. Because my main policy in my couple of campaigns has been climate. As you might remember, I was a delegate to the climate conference, the Global Climate Conference. Environment's been a big thing of mine for many years. So, and things are only getting worse climate-wise. So,
They're not. Come on. The buffoon in Washington, the turd in the Washington punch bowl tells us it's a hoax. Don't you believe him?
Oh, that's right.
It's a total hoax. Don't you believe him?
Of course. Like,
well, I believe him. I mean, the Liberal National Party here believes him.
Yeah, like people who think we went to the moon.
Did we?
No.
No. Did we go to the moon, Daryl? Do you remember if we went to the moon, or was it just a hoax?
No, we went to the moon.
Did we?
Yeah.
But the internet tells
Neil Armstrong.
Internet tells it's a hoax. Don't you believe everything you read on the net?
No.
What about that phone call from Nixon to 250,000 kilometres to the moon?
Yeah. No, it's all hoax. It's a hoax. You know that. It's all false news, bad news. Isn't it amazing? At the end of the first quarter.
Flat Earth.
Yeah. End of the first quarter of the 21st century, we're still talking this shit, that facts are no longer relevant and that people kowtow to that buffoon, you know? Unbelievable.
So
are you involved in some local environment action, I heard?
Yeah, I am actually. I'm secretary of what's called the Elwood Canal Action Team.
Excuse me, Elwood Canal.
Yes.
What is the Elwood Canal for the uninitiated?
Well, it used to be the Elster Creek.
Oh, right.
Ulster,
did you say?
No,
Elster, right.
Which I grew up on as a kid. I used to play in the Elster Creek up in East Brighton.
Uh-huh.
But it got barreled, you know, when I was about nine. And it's become at the end of the creek. Most of the creek goes underground. You don't see it anymore, but it's still there. And it pops out as the what's called the Elwood Canal.
Right.
But it's basically a sewer.
Right.
The Elwood Canal is a sewer.
And you want to save the sewer?
Yeah, we're trying to save the sewer. The person who kicked off this activist group is Tracy Harvey of the Whittles fame.
All right.
And Tracy lived next to the canal a couple of years ago and saw all the litter going down and started picking it out. And so this group has grown from that. We're now looking to try and bring about more of a catchment focus to the Elster Creek. The catchment is 41 square kilometres and it goes right up to Moorabbin, Mullumbeena, to Kingston, Bayside, and Port Phillip.
So was this canal used to drain the marshes, which was Mordialloc, Moorabbin, all those places?
Well, it was part of the marshes, the wetland of the Ulster Creek.
Yeah.
You know, it was the, you know, the fish nurseries of the Ulster Creek. You know, we call them, you know, they call them derogatorily, what were they called? Marshes or whatever.
Marshes, yeah.
Marshes are quite nice.
Just wastelands that needed to be bulldozed.
Yeah, that's right.
To build homes.
That's right, that's right. So, yeah, the work is involved in trying to clean up, really, the catchment.
Mm.
And we're working with the City of Glen Eira at the moment because they're in the upper part of the catchment and to help them manage their stormwater better because when most of the water in the catchment falls on the City of Glen Eira, but lands on houses in Elwood, houses and a lot of apartments in Elwood, of course. Right. And so we get drowned by the water that doesn't actually soak through or up there. So, but, you know, it's the contamination of the water that's really critical because it ends up in the bay and we have an indigenous species of dolphin in the bay that are critically endangered. They have the highest level of forever chemicals from plastics in their system. In the world. It's pretty bad.
Now, Sally, for last minute, look, I consider you to be a respected elder, right? Now,
thank you. I'm glad somebody does.
Yeah, and we may have somebody under 30 listening to this program. It is podcast, so hopefully a few under 30s will listen. Any advice to young people about what to do to try to remove all the damage our generation, you know, the baby boomers have caused? Any advice? Should they shoot us or should they just put us in nursing homes?
Both.
Both.
Look, I think maintain your age, I think, is the go.
Maintain your age, right.
Never give up. Maintain the hope and go for it. It's your turn, you know. I'm sorry. We're sorry. We've stuffed up.
We're sorry. Well, thank you, Daryl. Thank you. We'll let you wrap up the chat. Thank you very much, Daryl. Thank you very much, Sally Gibson.
Thank
this
you,
program
Joe.
Will be podcast. There will be a picture of Sally there, which Daryl has religiously taken. Are you giving me the fingers, or is that means we've got 2 minutes to go, mate?
Yeah, you got 2 minutes.
Oh, we got 2 minutes to go, Sally. Yep. You got another minute to harangue the young.
Well, harangue the young. Well, I think I've already harangued the young, but no, I'm very, you know, I know a lot of young people. I've got children, you know.
You got children?
Yeah, adult children.
How old are they? Adults? You got grandkids?
No.
You got adult kids? Yeah.
Yeah, I do. And I do actually have some three young children I regard as my grandchildren.
Mm-hmm.
But I've also got two adult daughters and they're both very active. You know, one works in the humanitarian sector.
Right.
The other is a social worker.
Right.
I mean, they're all doing their best and all my nieces and nephews, they all do their real best. Yeah. You know, I'm so proud of the young people.
I think people underestimate how active and how interested young people are.
I think so too.
It's just extraordinary.
They don't just go to concerts. I mean, they don't just go into Oasis.
That's right.
They do that.
It's all the old people that go to Oasis and ACDC. Now, I know it's the internet age, the worldwide. Is there any pages people can kind of contact you on you'd like to give us? Facebook pages, anything?
Yes, I do have a Facebook page. I've got an Instagram page.
Well, tell us how to get there.
Well, Sally Gibson. I'm on X as well. Look for me on X, Sally Gibson. Facebook.
That's it, just Sally Gibson.
Yeah.
You're the only one.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. I think maybe I'm not, but if you... I don't have any other name for my X page.
Right.
But, feel free to email me, sally@sallygibson.com.au.
sally@sallygibson.com.au. Even I could remember that. Could we put that on the podcast there? That'd be great.
Happy to hear from anybody.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you very much, Sally.
Thank you very much, Daryl.
You have been listening to Radical Australia with presenter Joe Toscano and special guest Sally Gibson. Here on 3CR Community Radio, 8:55 AM on your dial, online at 3cr.org.au, and this program has been podcasted. Stay tuned now for Brainwaves coming right up.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.